Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. On today's program, we're going to talk to illustrator Stacey Michelson, who says there is one way to be an artist. Just do it.
People always say, like, I wish I could be creative. But I always think, like, maybe that's why the adult coloring books is a popular thing. Like, people want to be, but they're intimidated to be creative. I don't know. I just always say, like, go for it.
You'll hear from the designer of KCRW's Good Food tote bag and picnic blanket. But first up, we all know that tech companies are disrupting city life in many ways, from Airbnb to ride-sharing to food delivery. But last week gave us some new twists on this trend, and we're going to talk about them. Let's start by playing something from Apple's big product launch last week.
We actually don't call them stores anymore. We call them town squares, because they're gathering places for 500 million people who visit us every year. Places where everyone's welcome and where all of Apple comes together.
That was Angela Arendts. She's Apple's Senior Vice President of Retail. So Apple is redesigning its retail experience, and it is using the language of town planning. To many ears, this sounded kind of strange. And one who felt that was Kristen Capps. He's a staff writer for CityLab. He covers housing, architecture and politics. And he joins us now. Kristen, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So what was so odd about this?
I think that if you've been following Apple closely in the ways that they've moved in real estate, this announcement wasn't a surprise. For a while now, they've been calling Apple stores Apple Experience or Apple Experiences. So the town square, quote unquote, is kind of a development that they've been pursuing for a while. It's funny because they're trying to sell experience and this kind of notion of minimalism, but they're a store. They sell stuff. They sell gadgets.
But what they're doing is pitching themselves as just a place for people to gather. Their stores are not necessarily where you come and shell out over $1,000 for their new phone. And in fact, here's Angela Arendts again explaining what will be in these stores.
We've designed new features to take the customer experience even further. In our largest cities where we can, we create a plaza, a space open to everyone. Come in and relax, meet up with friends, or just listen to a local artist on the weekends. Inside, we've designed a forum, a place for customers to come and create, collaborate, or just connect again with one another.
So do you buy it? Do you buy this notion that an Apple store is now a place where you'd go hang with your friends in the plaza?
I suppose it could be. If people want to spend their weekends or their free time hanging out in an Apple store, that seems like a perfectly fine decision. I personally do not. I want to spend as little time there as possible because I always spend a lot of money when I'm there. I think the question is really not what they think that they are creating and whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, but whether cities are going out of the way to facilitate Apple's vision. Here in Washington, D.C., Apple has pursued and appears to be very close to acquiring a Carnegie Library building, a former Carnegie Library building. And I think that that is too precious a use for Apple just because it is promising some kind of vague cultural component along with selling stuff.
And in fact, let's hear again from Angela Arendts. Here she is.
And we've recently announced an ambitious project to restore Carnegie Library in the heart of our nation's capital. We can't think of a better place for Today at Apple programs than a building originally created for the city to access knowledge and unlock their potential.
Okay, so if Apple stores today are sharing the knowledge, does it make more sense to install itself within this marvelous old library building?
I think we have to turn the question around and look at what do we want out of this marvelous old library building? And if what we want are public experiences, if what we want are lectures, talk, gallery exhibits, then there are just people who are massively more qualified to do that than Apple. And for a facility like a building like the Carnegie Library in Washington, D.C., which occupies its own public park, it's an Albert Randolph Ross design, Beaux-Arts treasure. It is just simply too precious to hand over to Apple when there could be a really brilliant public use for.
Now, Apple's also found other historic buildings and is in the process of restoring them. These glass and steel Apple cubes, you know, not appearing everywhere. And so they have stores in a former restaurant bay in New York's Grand Central Terminal. They have a Depression-era brick storefront in Brooklyn. They're in a 130-year-old former bank in Paris. So this is spreading, putting the new in the old.
Yeah, they have turned architecturally away from the big striking glass cubes and are going instead for the kind of old brick factory reuse. And that is, I think, a fine thing for them to do. But I think that city leaders and city's residents need to decide whether some of these architectural treasures, where there are real gems, deserve maybe a public use, something that is a benefit to all.
Sure. Now, it's not new for retail spaces to kind of rebrand themselves as town squares. One heard a lot of criticism perhaps 25 years or so ago when shopping malls were using that language, when you had designers like John Jurdi, you know, creating City Walk and calling that a street. And people got very upset at the time, saying this was privately owned space. You couldn't pretend that it was somehow public because it was controlled space and you couldn't have a political protest there, and there were guards who would determine who and who could not be in there. Are we entering a kind of new version of that same kind of concern where the corporate space claims somehow to be public?
I mean, there's always been a back and forth, like you describe with John Jurdi. In some sense, they have, in limited ways, succeeded at creating public spaces. I mean, a coffee shop, a cafe, a bookstore is not a true public space. It's not a space that belongs to the public, although we have kind of come up with our own uses for these spaces. So it's not wholly bad. It's just that when we do have true public space, a space that belongs to the city, that is hard to create. It is hard to generate new public parks. It's hard to generate new public spaces. So when we do have them, like we have in the form of the Carnegie Library, we must be very careful with them and our decisions about how we use them.
Now, you said using the language of cities is not entirely new to Apple. They've been kind of moving from store to experience, and now we're at Town Square. And this, in a way, builds on a trend that a lot of the tech companies have espoused. You know, many of them have these huge, huge headquarters or buildings, which are themselves sort of subdivided into streets and common areas that can be called plazas or public squares or whatever. The tech world has enjoyed creating these kind of mini cities within a building.
They're replicating the things that they want to about the urban experience, but not the things that they should, not the things that are actually going to drive our cities forward. Think about Foster and Partners kind of spaceship design for Cupertino that is, I believe, surrounded by 10,000 parking spaces. We know now that that's no way to design our cities and our public space. And what happens in Cupertino will be a design that causes the city to suffer under the strain of that much commuting, that much parking.
And Apple doesn't have childcare. You've got, thousands of employees who have driven to go to this job, and there is no childcare there, which, if you really are going to think of yourself as some kind of mini city, that's presumably got to be a piece of the picture.
I think there are a lot of ways in which we're designing these corporate environments that are kind of hostile. It seems like, especially to women who continue to bear the brunt of childcare and child rearing.
Sure. And this takes us to other ways in which big tech companies have been kind of intervening in the city experience. Let's just take a small instance that inflamed people on the internet. And that was two ex-Google guys who came out with this idea for basically a vending machine that would fill itself with products tailored to the needs of the building that it was in or demographic that it was serving. But they attached to it the name Bodega. And this got everybody irate, including you. What was so bothersome about this?
Well, it's really all in the name. Like you said, this is a very, very simple startup concept. It's a vending machine with an over elaborate method for tracking inventory. Apparently, it uses cameras and machine learning and face design to know when it's out of Tide and needs to be restocked and whether you want to buy Tide. But the name you get, and the name everyone understood right away. This was a startup that was going after corner stores that are beloved parts of the fabrics of our cities. It was tone deaf in an urban sense, but also in this in a racial sense, because, you know, so many bodegas are operated and owned by immigrant entrepreneurs. And it just seemed like a solution to a problem that maybe only Silicon Valley engineers have, which is interacting with people of color in local stores. It's not a problem for the rest of us.
But one of the partners was a person of color. He's from the Indian subcontinent, I believe.
That appears to be true as well. I can only tell you what this problem is that this pitch appears to solve, which is going to the corner store. Now, they might have avoided this entirely by calling it something like Pharma Box and pitching it as the CVS killer, as a way of like not having to go to the anonymous chain outlet on your corner. And I think that people would have greeted that a lot more warmly. This startup pitch really had no sense of that. Didn't seem to appreciate that from the name down, and yet had like 2.5 million in angel investment from the go.
Well, it honestly was bizarre because really, would it have got that 2.5 million if it had said, I am a vending machine? It seems like the marketing of this, as you say, slightly more sophisticated vending machine was just extraordinary to warrant that amount of money being thrown at it.
Well, I mean, they had this kind of sophisticated back end, apparently, that involves computer learning so it would recognize your face when you walk into your apartment building and know that you like to get a vitamin water or something like that. I mean, that seems actually more of a bug than a feature in my mind, the idea of like a vending machine that tracks my face and knows like how much liquor I'm buying every week. I don't know if I want some Skynet system to have that information at hand at all times.
Well, and closes off our desire for drinking something different some days, you know, or learning, being attracted to something we never thought we wanted. I mean, this notion of closing down our options rather than opening them up seems to be built into this concept and thereby is anti-urban.
Yeah, I think of bodegas broadly construed as true sites of innovation. I don't think that you would have a fidget spinner craze happening nationally or globally, however far it spans today, without the corner store to kind of sense that these were a thing and sell them.
I will say that there was one commentator, she's a senior editor at Mother Jones, who did make a very funny comment about, or she begged the question, you know, how is it that so many of these highly resourced ideas that come out of Silicon Valley are basically serving guys, and I'm not going to say just white guys, just guys who are no longer living at home with mother and need to have stuff done for them. They sort of are kind of replacement mother machines.
Yeah, that is pretty funny. I suppose as a guy who's no longer living at home with mother and who needs services, maybe I should appreciate this more. But I think that is part of the Silicon Valley mindset that itself needs some disrupting. And I don't know really where that starts, but the homogeneity of the ideas that are coming very well funded out of Silicon Valley definitely have some market appeal, but also some real significant missed opportunities, I think, by focusing so much on bachelors, a certain kind of bachelor that doesn't want to interact with humans. I mean, the thing about Soylent, for example, it seems to be this aggressively antisocial product, a kind of meal in a can that is designed for people who don't like to eat food. Bodega is a replacement that means you don't have to go to the corner store to buy, you know, toilet paper. All of these services that are designed around end gaming, like human experiences and human interactions, seem just to to be really kind of inhuman.
So we're talking about different ways in which tech is kind of tinkering with the real life of cities. I'm talking with Kristen Capps, and let's just talk about the really big tech meets city news, which was Amazon. Coming out as, you know, the potential savior of the one lucky city in North America that wins its hand to become HQ2, thousands of jobs coming to whichever city it selects. And yet, this is a company that through its business model is helping kill off cities, you know, or at least decimate Main Street retail.
I think that the city's response has really shown how fractured we feel about Amazon in general. You have many urbanist critics from all over saying, oh, God, no, please don't bring a second Amazon headquarters here. And then you have the city leaders in all of those same places saying, please, dear God, plant your Amazon headquarters here. And this schism reveals like a lot of different kind of priorities. They're pretty hard to suss out. The ways that an Amazon store could affect cities and the way that an Amazon store is likely to affect cities. The way it could affect cities could be really great. I mean, it would be great to, for many, many cities to have tens of thousands of new high-paying jobs. That's a good thing. At the same time, the competition that Amazon has opened up is really, really difficult because it's going to mean that cities are competing the way that they do for the Olympics, the way that they do for NFL stadiums, and it's a competition to the bottom.
Right, but what you're talking about is the deal that will occur between Amazon and the one city that gets the HQ2 and all these thousands of jobs. But generally, what Amazon's business model in the online retail piece that has made it this enormous company, that's the piece that is perhaps having a negative impact on many, many cities.
Well, you're right. There are these, more conflicting priorities that Amazon really kind of reveals. You know, we've done so much, and I think that we have such a widespread understanding about developing walkable cities and mixed residential and retail. And yet, by our consumer preferences, we want everything delivered. It's not just Amazon. It's services like Blue Apron, which not only delivers all of your food, but delivers them in like, you know, delivers the herbs in individual packaging. And it seems to be kind of confusing about why we built this and why we're building cities this way if we don't want to take advantage of local businesses. I am not a huge consumer of Amazon myself for that reason. I think that I like to keep, you know, money spent in my community if I can. But I also don't think that it's just an enormous inconvenience to go to the grocery store. In fact, I like going to the grocery store.
And let's go right back. Let's conclude by going back to Apple, which is Apple actually contributing to the life of cities in as much as it is bringing a lot of people to Main Street when it has a store there.
Yeah, I've not seen any research to track this, but I imagine that stores adjacent to Apple stores get some knock-on benefit from the Apple opening there. Certainly when I stop by the Apple store in Georgetown, which is closest to me, I might, you know, stop for a coffee at a coffee shop nearby or something like that. It's just that Apple is so desirable that it also has the ability to make demands of cities and say, well, we don't want as a company to just open a store the way that any other company in the world does. We want to be given a public park and a Beaux-Arts historic library to do it. And that is, I think, cities compromising too much in order to attract the attention of these corporate giants.
Well, Kristen Capps, what a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for giving us your time.
Thank you for having me.
That was Kristen Capps. He's a staff writer for CityLab, and he covers housing, architecture, and politics. I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. After this break, we're going to talk to an illustrator who brings food alive with the stroke of a pen.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car. Already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Green tea boba with a goofy face, smiling cheeseburgers and winking slices of pizza. Well, these are just some of the characters in a lineup of fun food and other creatures drawn by Stacey Michelson. She's the artist behind the Good Food tote bag and now the Good Food blanket that we've been offering as a premium during this pledge drive. Well, we at DNA wanted to meet Stacey herself and find out more about the person behind this fun food imagery. She's right here in the studio with us. Hello, Stacey.
Hello, Frances.
So tell us about yourself. Where were you raised? Did you study art?
Well, I'm from Huntington Beach, California, originally, so just down in the OC. I moved up here about 9 years ago. I did go to Art Center, but it wasn't for illustration. It was for film, actually, for a little bit. Super into music videos growing up. But yeah, I had a great arts program at Huntington Beach High School that had screen printing and photography. So I really got into doing those kind of graphic arts in high school.
That's actually pretty great to hear because we so often hear about the arts education being cut from high school, particularly in the public school system.
Yeah, and it was just a regular public high school. And I had an awesome teacher that would let me come after class. Like I started making bootleg band t-shirts because I would go to concerts and I always saw like t-shirts that were, you know, they were cut for guys, they weren't cut for girls, and they had weird graphics on them. So I started making like, oh, I should draw this, like this blur t-shirt would look awesome. And so I'd make like a couple for a few friends. But then when I started working in restaurants and doing, you know, signs for people and those kind of things, I feel like I was in a band at the same time. I started doing a lot of merch. It all kind of came together and I could use screen printing and I could use illustration to sell products. And I thought this is the best way to sell products and for people to see them.
So before we delve deeper into this, what was your instrument?
Oh, sing and guitar.
Cool.
Yeah.
Do you still do that?
In my bedroom. Yes.
But in terms of the trajectory your life went on, it went into the direction of the art.
Yeah. Well, it you know, most artists have a day job. So I was always a big foodie. But because you work in a restaurant, it's like you're that artsy person that has to do a special sign, has to do, you know, like, hey, let's do a shake of the month. Stace, can you draw that sign? So I feel like doing that kind of stuff, doing it funny, like the response that I would get from people when they'd be like, oh, my God, that shake has eyes and a mouth, like adding personality to stuff. Like, I don't know. That's the kind of stuff I love.
Now, I understand, though, that there was a trip away that was kind of pivotal in this journey towards doing food with funny faces.
Yes, Japan.
Tell us about that.
So I went there when I turned 18. Like that was like a birthday trip with a close friend. And just seeing like the packaging, like everything being so fun and funny. Like I always loved that. Like I'd pick up something that I don't even necessarily eat or want to eat. And you see it and you're just like, oh my God, like what is this dried shrimp? This is so cute. And it's like, I don't even eat shrimp, but I want it. But, you know, that kind of thing. I don't know. It kind of made me think in a different way of how you can use art for all sorts of things that you use in your everyday life.
You definitely don't sound like the person that's on the kind of terribly serious conceptual fine art track.
No. And those I don't think are my people. Like, I feel like there's a place for those people. But like, I'm like more the goofball, the person that like people are like, what do you do all day? And I'm just like, draw, like, you know, make stupid songs. Like, that's what I do all day. And then it turns into, you know, a little bit more focused where then you have an assignment and you know, you've finished it and you have a product.
So let's talk about the drawings, because the drawings are simple. Simple, I don't mean simple as in...
Yeah, they're line drawings.
They're simple line drawings.
Yeah.
And there's sometimes color and you use a few lines to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you saw other artists doing that inspired you? Is it something that just came completely naturally?
Well, I actually got in trouble for that in high school art class, like, you know, where the teacher's like, you need to learn about shading. And I was like, no, I just want to draw this little cartoon. So I don't know where that style actually comes from. I mean, you know, I had a Shel Silverstein book growing up. I had, you know, I had Ed Emberley. Like, I had those kind of things. But the actual, like, fine arts, I was never good at those classes. Like, I'm not good at, like, drawing a face or a still life.
There's a big trend, as I'm sure you're aware right now, for coloring books.
And for adults.
For adults.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly that trend is because there's some kind of desire right now for people to use their hands and put pen to paper, because maybe, you know, the digital world we live in takes us away from that experience.
Yeah.
Do you feel that people like your work because of the kind of handmade, you know, the finger to the pen to the paper quality it has?
Yeah. And I do a lot of shows like Unique LA, Made in LA type of design shows. And I feel like people always say, like, I wish I could be creative. But I always think, like, maybe that's why the adult coloring books is a popular thing. Like, people want to be, but they're intimidated to be creative. I don't know. I just always say, like, go for it, because it's like anything. Like, you can try to cook and it could be terrible. But, like, you know, it either turns you off of cooking or then you want to cook more. So I don't know. I feel like the same way with art.
So the food thing started, the drawing the food started, because you yourself got interested in food.
Correct.
And that's because you took a position on food, as in there's certain foods you don't eat.
Oh, the vegan thing. I'm part of the vegan cult. It is true.
But in terms of drawing food, mm-hmm. you draw the whole panoply of foods. Is that right?
Yeah. And, you know, like with the picnic blanket, there is a picnic scene. And that was kind of, you know, that idea was thrown out from one of the good food producers. Like, hey, what if Stacy drew a blanket and it could have a picnic and sandwiches and cheese and all that? And at first somebody might think, oh, you don't eat cheese. But it's like nowadays it's like, I mean, I had a party and I had all these vegan cheeses. So it's like, I just look at that stuff and it is food that I eat. Like, if I see a BLT and I'm like, oh my God, I want to eat that. It is like my version of a BLT.
And the drawing for good food that mm-hmm. is what that brought about this relationship that's now led to this blanket. Are you literally sitting there listening to good food with your pen in hand, scratching away when Evan stimulates a thought?
Yeah, well, you know, that started as just kind of like recording things that I would hear that I wanted to come back to, almost just like drawing in my sketchbook. They would talk about some recipe and I'd be like, oh, I don't want to forget that. So I'd draw it down, kind of just a quick little sketch. Or they would talk about something that I thought was really interesting. Like, one time they were talking about dates and how they come from the date palm tree and all these things. And I looked it up and I thought, oh, that's so crazy. Like, and I drew a picture of that. They were talking about truffles, like how everybody thinks pigs always sniff them out, but like nowadays they use dogs. So I drew a little comparison, and I feel like then it became this thing of like, I should do this every week, because at the end of the year, I will have this amazing thing that I could make a zine out of, or just a collection of all these great food facts. But it was just like a few things here and there. And now it's like, let's do every episode. Like, I listen to it live and then come back to it, listen again, kind of Google a few things for reference and draw it.
Would you ever want to merge your artistic talents and your veganism and do kind of food activism? You know, if Peter came to you and said, could you do some drawings for us?
Sure, Peter, let's talk. Let's do it. Yeah, you know, the vegan community, especially in LA, there's so many things that are that happen. It's like there's the Vegan Beer Fest that's now called Eat, Drink, Vegan. There's Vegan Street Fair. And there was a pretty cool thing where I did Veganaise, which is like a very popular.
I love Veganaise.
Yeah, so they turned 40, which is hard to believe. But they asked me, because I'm known in the vegan community, they asked me to design something for their label. So yeah, go to Whole Foods and you'll see it. I did all these little funny sandwiches that are all over the Veganaise bottles.
Oh my gosh. And for anyone that doesn't know, Veganaise was invented in the Southland.
Yeah, and it's a vegan mayo product, and I feel like a lot of people, I mean, people in my family that are not vegan, they have it in their fridge. Like, I was finding out when people started posting that on Instagram, like, how many of my non-vegan friends were like, oh my God, Stace, did you do this? Like, and they're holding, like, posing with the bottle, and they buy that product, and I was like, that's so cool. I mean, it tastes delicious, so it's awesome to be associated with them, too, because they're a very cool, you know, vegetarian company. Small business.
Who are your favorite characters right now, of your own characters?
Well, Grumpy Coffee, you know, he's the guy that I made the stop motion animation of. So I wrote a little song about him. And then I had a friend that had like a setup with the camera that was mounted and everything. He helped me do the stop motion. And we, you know, kind of just came up with a story.
Grumpy Coffee, he hates waking up. Put some milk and sugar in his cup. He'll get you to school. Woo! He'll get you to work.
Yeah!
He'll make you feel great so you're not a jerk.
I think people connect with him because they see him and they go, oh my God, that's so my boyfriend. Or they go, oh my God, that's so me. Like, I can't do the day without a cup of coffee. So like grumpy coffee, I mean, I wake up and I'm kind of like, what am I going to do today? So I'm not grumpy coffee, but I love him because he's just a grump. And then there's Miss Matcha. She's like the boba, the matcha tea. Like, I love Japanese stuff, so I love matcha. And then Jimmy, he's the donut, sprinkled donut. Yeah, I don't know. I love those guys.
Well, Stacey, what a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I loved being here. Let's do it again.
That was Stacey Michelson. I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. Ray Guana mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman. And thank you very much for listening.